Hi, you're listening to Sequential Statement, a monthly comics and storytelling podcast brought to you by Sequential State, a comics criticism project dedicated to thoughtful commentary and reviews of alternative and independently published comics. I'm Alex.
And I'm Nick.
And this is episode number one, Introductions. Check us out at www.sequentialstate.com and follow the podcast on Tumblr at sequentialstatement.tumblr.com, where you can find links to the things discussed in this episode and see additional show notes. A quick orientation, since this is our first show. Sequential Statement is a storytelling and comics review podcast. Nick and I have been talking about this show for about a year now, and we're really excited to bring it to you. You can expect personal stories, think pieces, banter, and we hope that you'll love it and come back. Please let us know what we can do to improve the cast by dropping us a line at sequentialstate@gmail.com. My name is Alex Hoffman, and I've been writing comics criticism for about 8 years. Sequential State is my latest project focusing on independent and self-published comics, micropress, small press, zine culture, and manga publishing.
And I'm Nick Dutro. I've been reading comics, primarily American and superhero fare, for most of my life, starting with Introductions via Batman the Animated Series and X-Men cartoons on Saturday mornings. Today I'm a trained journalist working in Northwest Ohio, and I recently published my own comic, Multi.
So, listeners, in case you haven't noticed, Nick's focus in comics and my focus in comics are very different. And I think that that's something that we're going to hopefully meld together really well, and hopefully we'll have fun with. But the things that Nick focuses on are things that I don't necessarily have a good beat on, so he fills me in on the new stuff from commercial comics. I tend to be the one who's handing him books from artists like Michael DeForge saying, take a look at this. So that mix is one of the things that I think is really that we're going to be excited about.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we both check out a few things that are similar. Obviously, you're doing a few more art house books. My focus, you're right, is on kind of the big three, if you will, Marvel, DC, and I'm regularly reading almost everything that comes out of Image. So, yeah, we definitely have a little bit different, regular reading tastes, but the nice thing is we can come together and talk about some books that that maybe people haven't heard a whole lot about. All right, we're going to get into it. Alex, do you have a story to tell us?
Sure, I do. So my story today is one of the experiences I've had that's been the most fun in indie comics, and this was this year at TCAF. The day before the doors opened, a comics reading was done at a dive bar close to The Beguiling, which is one of the major indie and alt comic shops in Canada and Toronto. And it was readings by authors who were being published by 2D Cloud, Youth in Decline, and Space Face Books. And Nick, this reading, I don't want to call it a shit show, but it definitely got off on the wrong foot. So I am incapable of showing up to anything on time. I'm always either 15 minutes late or half an hour early. And so I was there half an hour early. And of course, it was like awkward because I'm like the audience and half of the people that were presenting hadn't showed up yet. But I got to be there to experience the AV malfunctions of the site. So one of the cartoonists who was reading, Kathy G. Johnson, and one of the publishers, Ryan Sands, had to basically troubleshoot the entire AV setup. And we were crammed into this second floor of this dive bar. And there are pieces of the floor that are missing. And they've recently been replaced with new pieces of wood. And a guy comes in with in the middle of Kathy and Ryan trying to fix the whole thing. Like, you know, just, you know, make it work. A guy comes in with a can of varnish and starts varnishing the floor. So, like, here we all are, it's like 90 degrees, it is cooking in this bar, and here comes the dude with a rag and varnish to, just make it even more pleasant for everybody that's trying to, like, get this business set up. So, like, we're all just aghast. And after a lot of trials and tribulations, we eventually, I say we, but really Ryan and Kathy got the thing going. The reading itself was great. Absolutely wonderful time, and I had a great time afterwards hanging out with some of the artists that had presented or who were there. But just one of those, it was one of those moments where you're like, oh my god, what is going on here? Like, and no one from TCAF or The Beguiling was at the reading, so it was just like one of those moments where, well, you just just got to make it work, I guess. But really funny and one of my favorite parts about TCAF this year.
That's awesome.
All right, and that kind of leads us to our reviews. We've got three comics for you today that we're going to talk about. Eight House Arclight number one, which is illustrated and colored by Marion Churchland and written by Brandon Graham. The Divine with art by Asaf and Tomer Hanuka. I'll probably butcher some names on this cast. And that's written by Boaz Levy. And finally, They Are Not Like Us, Volume 1, with art by Simon Gain, colors by Jordi Belair, letters and design by Phonographics, and written by Eric Stevenson. So first up is Eight House Arclight, number 1. So a little bit of background on this comic. This is an Image book. It's a periodical floppy comic. Essentially, what I understand about the series is that it's a shared universe with four different teams working inside the same creative framework. So this is the first issue that's come out of the series, and I believe that there are going to be four different books, each of which is going to be a four-issue miniseries. This may all change, or I could be completely off base. But the first book introduces us to this world, Krev Ropa, and we get a sense of the kind of creative energy that's going to be coming out of this project. Quickly, to kind of recap, it appears that we've got two main characters, a Lady Knight, I should say Sir Arclight, and then a lady who appears to be some sort of elemental or person that's bound up in some sort of strange wooden body. And it's an interesting amalgamation of what appears to be both science fiction-y looking things and fantasy looking things. A couple pages in, we can see something that looks a lot like a science outpost, but the two characters perform a magic ritual halfway through the beginning of the book. What's really interesting, I think, about this comic is Churchland's art, which is just absolutely gorgeous. The colors are beautiful. The character designs are really intelligent. They make a lot of sense. There is just a lot to love about how this book looks. The warm and cold tone transitions throughout the book are really fascinating. I'm really a big fan of what Churchland is doing here.
Something that jumps out at you, throughout this story, there's a little bit use of blood, and with the color palette being kind of muted or, you know, kind of organic in the way it is, the red contrasts so much with everything else in the story. It's very, very interesting. Just kind of visually shocking at times. Not that it's obtrusive or anything like that. It just adds such an interesting element to the story, that use of a stark red against so many kind of earthen tones and background. So really, again, just the use of color is really undeniably incredible.
Nick, you're absolutely right that a lot of the tones are earthen or muted tones. The only times that we see these really bright colors are in these scenes. And there's one panel in particular, which is in the middle of the book. It's almost like dusk, and Sir Arclight has to stick her finger on this statue, and it's the only panel in the entire comic that's like this bright pink color, and everything mm-hmm. else is these sepia tones. So it's some really interesting decision making in terms of coloring and design.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see what more comes out. This was the week that this came out was the week before Brandon Graham released his anthology series Island. So he is definitely trying some new things recently. People may know Brandon Graham as the writer and artist behind King City and multiple Warheads. He also wrote the book Profit for Image. So he's been kind of hanging around the comic scene for a little bit. And to see him do some writing pieces that are, you know, all of them so vastly different than the next thing. I mean, on one hand, there is nothing in comics like King City. There's nothing like multiple Warheads. But these other stories, this is a straight up fantasy story, what you would kind of expect from a fantasy story. And Prophet was kind of, you know, a genre piece, very, very much a sci-fi, kind of lone wanderer type story. So to see him do so many different things coming out of one creative voice is just very, very interesting. So I'm excited to see where this series goes next. I think that there's probably a lot of good things that are going to come out of it. And I'm definitely excited for what the next issue is and hopefully the next storyline.
Yeah, I think it certainly has a different tone from his more irreverent works like King City and Multiple Warheads. I was introduced to King City through the original Tokyo Pop releases. And I don't really want to get started about Tokyo Pop, but thankfully King City was able to be pulled away from its licensing rights black hole, which is Tokyo Pop, in order to be published in a really nice floppy comics and then collected in a nice large size trade. And that's a comic that I've kept around for a while, so I'm really excited about A House. This is a really neat story, a good introduction. I would say that maybe it's a little light on content in the sense that not a lot happens. I'm used to mainstream comics having a lot of stuff packed in to each installment, but I will say that I really love the way it looks, and I think that the fantasy elements kind of mixed with some of the more interesting stuff that's going on here, really something that I'm going to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. I'm going to jump into The Divine, do a quick introduction of this book. You don't really get to it until the back of the story, so I want to just bring this up really quick. The cover of Divine has this really interesting picture of two kids, one of them smoking a cigarette, they're carrying around gold, and one of them has grenades on his belt. And on the inside, on the back of this book, we have a picture of two children, one of them smoking a huge cigar, and it's based on a January 2000 photo from the Associated Press photographer, I'm going to say this wrong, Apicart Weiriong, a photo of two 12-year-old twins who the picture was taken after a raid of a hospital by the Thai army, and it showed these twins who had held 800 people hostage, and there were stories about these twins having magical powers, and they became these larger-than-life characters, and out of that picture spun The Divine, which deals a little bit with, you know, the military and natural forces at work. It's a little bit hard to pin down from a storyline standpoint because there's kind of so, I don't want to say there's even so many moving parts. There's really not. But the story kind of never has like a strong enough plot for me necessarily to give an actual story account of what all occurred in it. What are your thoughts on The Divine? How do you pigeonhole or peg this story?
So I think just to start talking about it, I will say that I'm not sure who did the colors on this book. They are fabulous. So we have art by Asaf and Tomer Haneke, and I don't know who did the colors. Maybe they both collaborated on them. But there's a lot going on in terms of transitions from warm and cool colors and utilizing really bright colors contrasting with, so pinks contrasting with greens, and very really smart color usage. That being said, and the art is gorgeous. It's, you know, one of the main reasons why you would look at this book. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
What I would say, though, is that as a story, the comic kind of leaves me a little light. Really, the pacing of this whole thing, it almost feels like you're not really at the first part of the story. Like, you haven't really gotten into the story until about halfway through the book, when the main character is kidnapped by these two twins. So that's like page 73, 74, and the book itself is only about, the book itself is about 150 pages. So I feel like the introduction moves at a glacial pace, just absolutely nerve-wrackingly slow. And then the second half moves so blisteringly fast that it just felt uneven.
Yeah, I agree completely. And it's something I was thinking of as reading this book. You know, I've been trying to peg it in the world of, like, movies. this would be a hard movie to sell, where we don't get to our hook characters until about halfway through. And then when we do, we don't really get a chance to ever, you know, sit with them. These two characters, the twins, should have had so much character coming out of them. And instead, that's not really the case. You know, they are there. They definitely have a place, but they're kind of paper thin in their characterizations. We don't get a whole lot of character motivation out of them. And aside from really the incredible visuals of this book, there's not a whole lot of other hook to it, which is too bad because I've been reading first, second books. I get a lot of great stuff out of first, second books. And this, you know, for being one of their high profile pieces, it didn't do it quite for me as some of their other stuff has. So I hate to tell people it's a pass because for the art itself, it's well worth the price of admission. But the story just doesn't hook you enough to really make that keep going. It's a great book to flip through. The colors are unbelievable, and the art is just top notch. I want to see more from this creative team for sure. Yeah, I just hope they have a little bit stronger story.
I would definitely agree there. From a personal aside, there is one part of the story where it like really freaks me out. So I am famously known for really hating finger stuff. Like a great example, like Black Swan, where she's like ripping at her fingernails or pulling at her fingers. That gave me nightmares for weeks. And I'm not a person that gets up and gets out, like leaves theater. So I just sat there and endured that. And everybody that was sitting around me like noticed the fact that I was in a dead sweat and was digging holes into the armrests of the chair at the movie theater. So when that scene, I think around the 75 page mark where he's having his like finger like broken off, that I almost put down the book and said, "All right, I'm done." But the color and the pacing, or at least the pacing in the second half, really drew me back in. And I keep on saying the color, but really, honestly, it's fantastic. And there's some really smart choices in terms of when the background color changes. So you can see a lot with mood. The two main characters have a lot of interactions, and you can tell when things get a little heated. Because the background will change from like a, you know, like green to red or green to pink, mm-hmm. or blue to pink. So you can see, or blue to yellow. So you can see when it gets heated. Really smart choices just from a design perspective. But yeah, ultimately, a comic that I was expecting a lot more for and I was a little disappointed by.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to, I feel remiss because we haven't talked a whole lot about the main characters. Where, you know, the two characters we see on the cover of the book are not quite the main characters, as you said. We don't get introduced to these twins until about halfway through. Two main characters are Americans. They are in this country to start a mining operation, or at least get that mining operation kick-started. And one of the gentlemen is a deplorable human being, and you get that as the story goes on. The other one, our main character, who we follow through most of the story, is kind of, you know, non-existent. There just isn't a whole lot that we get out of this character, and potentially that's because he is supposed to be there as the reader's eyes to see the world around him and experience things, and we experience it as him, as a blank slate. But again, there's not enough, you know, he doesn't have enough character motivation ever that we ever feel that attached to him. And, you know, potentially that, too, is where the story suffers a little bit in that we just don't have anyone, even if we're supposed to be looking through their eyes, we don't have anyone that we really connect with in this entire story.
Yeah, the main character, Mark, I mean, he seems like a nice guy. He's got good intentions, et cetera, et cetera. But the blonde, the deplorable human named Jason, he's a train wreck. And I guess the contrast between those two characters allows you to kind of glory in what eventually happens to Jason. You're supposed to compare and contrast the two characters, I feel, but it really what happens is Jason is so over the top that Mark ends up getting washed out, kind of, and his motivations tend to be a little less clear. Mm-hmm. So a mixed bag with the Divine. I really love the art. I really think that the colors are fantastic. There's some really cool design choices, but the story is just too uneven for me to say that I really think that every person should read it.
Absolutely.
So, all right. And then the last book we're talking about is The First Trade of They're Not Like Us. So when I was little, I watched the X-Men cartoon just like Nick did. I didn't realize there were comics. I just thought it was just a thing that you watched on TV. But if you can imagine, They're Not Like Us is sort of like X-Men, but if Professor Xavier was a murderous sociopath.
I like to think about it as X-Men as written by Fight Club. And not even like Chuck Palahniuk Fight Club, like just like the characters in Fight Club wrote X-Men. You know?
Yeah.
Put that together themselves.
It's like the Fight Club's comic.
Yeah.
So it features a group of, I don't want to call them misfits, they're like people with special powers.
And I will say the powers are very downplayed. Almost all of them are telepathics, there's some telekinetics, people who use their mind over matter. We don't see people with claws or anything like that. These are all very subdued characters in what they can achieve.
And it kind of mirrors some of the old, you know, code names and like the Wolverine, Nightcrawler, etc. All these characters have assumed or given names, or like leader of the group.
The voice,
yes, wipes everybody's memory of their old identity, basically. He's the most powerful telepath. The other folks are, one girl can move very quickly, one person is invulnerable, one person's strong. But Nick is right in that there's not, the powers aren't really played out for what they could be, like the X-Men where it shows up all the time.
Mm-hmm. I want to say, you know, as getting into this story, one of the things about it that differs, if you will, from the X-Men is that the voice definitely has more sinister motivations than Professor Xavier ever did. The story still plays out in that idea, and even in the title, that you're different than everyone else around you. It's the storyline you can easily pick up from the X-Men, is that the X-Men, the mutants, are different, and the nice thing is that readers can pick that up. I mean, if you're the kind of kid who's reading comic books, sometimes there's, you know, something about society that you don't quite understand, it doesn't quite mesh with you, you feel like an outsider of. This book takes that, turns on its head a little bit, and says, yeah, we are different. There is something different about you. And instead of living in harmony with society as the idea of the X-Men has always been, it's, you know what, let's hurt people. Let's really put ourselves into society in a kind of violent way, which was a little hard to deal with. The violence is not over-the-top fun. It's a little bit over-the-top in your face. And that's a little bit frustrating. Luckily, the characters don't relish in that. Our main character, we never see her excited to be in that frame of reference, necessarily. She always feels like that's the wrong thing to do. And maybe that's what's nice, is that this book has a lot of... the characters do feel pretty strong. They do kind of speak for the reader in some way. We don't ever feel like this was the right choice for them to be violent, for them to be awful to the rest of society. But that doesn't make it any easier to read at times.
Yeah. I think, so we've been referencing X-Men a lot, and one of the things I think about with X-Men is, like, the whole idea of mutants as outcasts or genetic, you know, genetic determinants, and I've always kind of thought about X-Men as a race story, even, you know, in terms of, like, segregation and discrimination, etc. I haven't really put a whole lot of thought into that. I'm sure that there are a lot of people that have talked a lot about that, but this is really not that kind of story. It is... It's more of a, look at how awful the world is. Instead of being like that, kind of having that racial aspect to it, it's more like the dueling sides of human nature. So there's this empathetic, we can make the world better, we can do better, you know, that human optimism thing. Versus, so that would be represented by Sid in this comic, who's the main female character. And then the you know, everything is shit, the world is going to burn, like, you know, nothing can ever be good. That whole human pessimism is represented by the voice. And to see those two kind of duke it out over the course of this first volume of the comic is really interesting, because it seems like, despite how brutal this first trade is, it really does seem like the positive aspects of humanity can win over the pessimism of humanity.
Yeah, and I think that definitely is something to pull out of here. Yeah, definitely for sure. That's a good point. You got into race a little bit, and I think that there's definitely you can look at the X-Men as a race story. Bryan Singer, who directed the X-Men, looks at it as a story about gay rights. And there's a lot you can pull out of the X-Men storyline that kind of fits into whomever you are. My issue with this was, at least from the voices aspect, that the story wasn't so much about trying to live in society as much as, you know, to an extent, these kids are terrorists. You know, what they are doing is, instead of just learning how to cope and live in society, it is sticking the middle finger up to society and, you know, asserting themselves in a way that is uncouth. And you know, that hit me so hard in this that it was almost hard to see those positive aspects, which there are some. Getting into those, some good things I really liked. The art is great in this book. The visuals of the covers that they show in here are incredibly striking. It's why, you know, honestly, it's why I picked up this book to begin with, because the covers are just so striking, and the art is great. And the colors by Jordi Belair, just awesome. I love her work. She has also did the excellent colors on the Moon Knight series from Marvel recently. And I think she's one of the best colorists working in the industry right now. There's a lot of really positive things to say about this book. It brings me to Eric Stevenson's other book that he did a couple years ago, Nowhere Men, which I feel like has some of the same issues with this. To me, he just seems like he really wants to write, you know, straight-up American superhero comic books, but he's doing it in a way that, you know, changes stuff or goes in a more independent stream of thought. His X-Men story here before with Nowhere Men, it felt like an Inhumans story where people discover their powers, but both of them suffer the same issue, which is that they have such huge, sprawling casts that you never get to meet anybody for sure. And I think that gets lost. I mean, there's just so many characters in this book that I didn't connect with many of them, with the exception of Sid and the voice, where people were showing up on and off panel, and I didn't know who they were. They do introduce us, and they give us the names over and over again, but I don't know who any of these characters are, and hopefully they fix that in the later volumes of this book if we get to see more of it. So that's probably my biggest complaint, though, is I just... there were so many people, and I just didn't ever feel like I knew any of them.
I think that's one of the major problems with some of these superhero books, is that the cast is so big. Like, X-Men has always had that issue, I think, that, you know, if you're trying to pack six or seven people into a 32-page story, that can be really a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this book suffers from that as well. I want to talk about the art a little bit, because it seems really referential to Paul Pope's style, at least the line work. It's one of the first things I noticed about this book. Now, this is becoming more and more a thing, I guess. Not that the way Paul Pope's line work looks is necessarily unique. The more I look, the more I find people that have a line work style that's very similar to his. In a way, this is more subdued. The lines are more controlled. So it is different, but there's a sharpness to it. There's an energy to the line that is really appealing. And really what sold this comic to me above all its other qualities, the story is maybe not my cup of tea. I was able to read it just fine and thought it was interesting. But I think that the colors and the art are really what make this story worth looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's another book we have this week where we're the colors and the art kind of triumph over the actual plot of the product, which is too bad. But you know, there's so many great artists working today that maybe I'm okay with that.
Hey, another thing I want to point out about this book is the diversity of the cast, which is, I think, important. I'm looking at the main cast. It's, I think, in a team of like 10 people, 5 or 6 of those people are people of color, and I think that it's done in such a way that's really it works really well. again, I think that mainstream, and I say mainstream as like those big three comics, have a lot to do in terms of improving representation of both folks that are queer as well as folks that are people of color. I think that this comic includes people of color in a way that is that doesn't feel shoehorned, and I think that that's important. I do have some problems with the way that the women in this story are represented, despite having some of the more powerful abilities, like super speed, so kind of like a Flash character, a character Maisie who can see the future, and Sid who apparently seems to be a telepath at the same level as the voice, oftentimes are treated in ways or depicted in ways that are seemingly sexist to me. One of the things that really bugs me about the first half of this book is that Sid, the main character, is walking around in a hospital gown for two whole issues. So yeah. For like 64 pages, she's just walking around in a hospital gown, which is weird, but it's done in such a way so that there are often times where you're looking at her back where it's tied in the back. And it's like, is that really necessary? Like, some of that I just find completely unappealing. And so it's one of the problems I have with this comic.
Yeah, and I think there's something to agree with there. The voice outshines most of the other female characters. Sid really seems to do her best when she is kind of romantically linked to one of the other characters. And while I agree with you that it does have a nice, diverse cast, lots of women in this story, lots of non-whites, part of the reason I don't think we ever get to see them discuss any race relations, we don't get to see those characters ever go into anything. I think that we get strong characterizations from them because we don't ever learn those characters still. They don't ever have a chance to say anything about race in there. And that's, you know, that again is an issue with having such a large, and you know, a large cast that just doesn't ever get the screen time that maybe some of them deserve.
Right. So the representation is there, kind of, but it seems like still the main characters of people that get the most focus are still white people, and it seems that the people of color are the ones that are easily expendable.
Yeah.
And or don't get a lot of screen time. And I think that that's a shame. I mean, so clearly, even though it seems like they're trying, you know, the author and artists are trying to include more people of color, still I think that this is still not, you know, it still needs to, there still needs to be more that's done, basically.
Yeah, I think it, and maybe some of that will change in future volumes of this story. I mean, we're looking at the first story in it, just collected into trade just a couple of weeks ago. So there's a lot more that can be done going forward. I don't know what their publication schedule is. I don't know if they have more stories planned in this yet. I'm interested to see what they could do next, but I was not sold with this first volume, which is too bad. Usually that's not the case with Image books. Image has a great track record of hooking me at their first, you know, in their first book. But, you know, that's the great thing about working with independent publishers. You know, an independent publisher like Image is, there's such a diversity and a wealth of resources there that you never know what you're going to pick up with the next story.
So, Nick, this is the end of the show. Do you have anything that you'd recommend to our listeners? Any media, book, music that's caught your attention recently?
Absolutely. I've been kind of mainlining the new Ratatat album, listening to that quite a bit. It was on NPR's First Listen there a couple weeks ago. I believe that album has dropped now, so it's well worth checking out. Ratatat's a group I really enjoy. I also just finished up the newest season of BoJack Horseman on Netflix, and that series continues to be just one of the best things that Netflix does, and maybe the darkest cartoon ever made. It's excellent. Go check it out. It's wonderful. Everyone has Netflix, or somebody they know has Netflix, so BoJack Horseman, go watch it all. It's wonderful.
I need to borrow somebody's Netflix account so that I can watch that show.
You should. But, you should. You'll love
it. But, yeah, I've heard a lot of good things. So my recommendation this week is a book by Wesley Chu. It's called Time Salvager. It's a story about a far-flung future where humanity is fighting to survive extinction, and they're doing so by going back in time to salvage power, essentially these great power engines or power sources that humanity created when it was in a more of a better time, when humanity was much more likely to, you know, succeed and make it out of the solar system. It's really smart science fiction in the sense that it kind of makes some bold predictions about what the future looks like. It has a really in-depth chronology that's really fascinating, and an interesting look at time travel, all of which I think are really cool. I'm about halfway through it, and I can't put it down.
That's awesome. Well, I think that does it. Anything more?
I think that's it.
Okay. Well, thanks again for listening to Sequential Statement. Links to the media discussed in this show are in our show notes. Our theme music is by Today's Man off their self-titled album. I'm Nick.
And I'm Alex.
And we'll talk to you soon.